I'm Joanna Shanks.
I'm Emma Taylor.
And this is Murder, She Spoke.
So we need to talk about Unsolved Mysteries, about the Patrice Andrews case. I know you've watched it as well.
Yeah, so it is a reboot of the original Unsolved Mysteries.
I did think so because of the titles. They've got the guy in the background.
And also I think the music's the same, but they've just modernised it kind of thing. And I've always loved Unsolved Mysteries, so I knew that I would enjoy it, but I did really enjoy it. But yeah, the second case, Patrice Andrews.
I think we're going with Andrews, yeah.
Yeah. Holy shit.
Unbelievable. I had to pre-warn you about that guy because I just couldn't handle him. I was getting so annoyed. I was sitting next to Richard and every time he did something, I was like, that's a bit suspicious, isn't it? I mean, why would you do that? What's that behaviour all about?
Yeah.
Just the whole way through.
It's funny because it was almost, not instantly, but very quickly, he mentioned having the criminology degree. And I was like, that's weird. And then as he went on, I was like, oh my God, you fucking bastard. Yeah. You've ruined this kid's life.
Mm-hmm.
I don't care if he was a shithead.
Druggy or anything. Yeah.
Shithead teenager. I don't care. He wasn't his fucking kid. And to apparently get with this woman who he claimed to love, then treat her son like absolute shit. And then even after the fact, the day after her body was found, change the locks, kick the boy out of his house, not allow him to return and get his stuff, keep a hold of his mum's ashes. That boy, that poor fucking boy, must have been, God knows what he went through.
Yeah. I felt like they really downplayed that. And I loved the way that they did it because it really just told the story itself and let you draw your own conclusions. Because it was like, yeah, so he changed the locks and wouldn't let me get my stuff. And you're like, sorry, what?
Yeah.
And then you cut to Rob and he kind of tries to flip it and they go, oh, you know, just for security because she'd gone missing the day after. I just thought, oh, maybe I should change the locks. And you're okay, so he's not even denying it,
corroborating what he's saying.
Yep. And then 2 seconds later he says something along the lines of, and I wasn't letting that kid back in the house. And you're like, wow, he's not even trying to disguise the fact that he is a horrific human being. He is outright saying, I hated her son. What age was he? He was 15, was he? 14 or 15. And he's, oh, I think that he was jealous of how close we were. Yeah, so close that she was thinking about divorcing you.
Yeah, absolutely.
Which you've never heard about before. Really strange. Really strange that. The whole way through, things that he was saying just threw up so many red flags. And when you looked at the pictures of them, he was very possessive. He always had his arms around her like a cage. Yeah, there were so many things that I was seeing that just were irking me. And then it just grew and grew and grew. So yeah, I would not be surprised. And it really also annoyed me that the police, was it the sheriff's office, who was saying, oh yeah, we've worked out the timeline, and although it would make it really difficult for him to do it, he still could have done it.
Yeah,
you're smart, but you ain't that smart.
Yeah, they didn't completely rule it out. They didn't say it would be impossible for him to do this,
because that was what he was aiming for.
Yeah, so after I watched the episode, I immediately took to Reddit because I wanted to see what people were saying about it. And a couple of things stuck out to me that I didn't see mentioned by anyone else. Because, you know, everybody observes things differently. First of all, my first sort of, moment was when I noticed that at the beginning of when they were interviewing, or, you know, the camera crew were speaking with Rob Andrews, I don't know if he was shaking or if he was like jiggling his leg, but he, like, his body was shaking. So whether he was actually shaking or had a sort of a jittery knee or something, yeah, was what the first thing that I noticed about him. And I was like, that's odd, because coming into it, I immediately thought he's the grieving husband. You know, I didn't suspect him, even though, you know what the statistics probably say about the husband being, you know, the likely culprit.
The husband did it.
Yeah. But, and the other red flag, another thing that I didn't see mentioned by anyone, was one of the things that bothered me was he was talking about the fact that he got fuel, which was obviously to prove that he was so far away at the time, or shortly after, whatever. And he says that he had a receipt and it was time stamped and everything. But he talked about it in like the possessive, so as if he still had it. Mm-hmm. And that was really bizarre to me, because I thought, if I buy petrol, one, I don't take a receipt. I know some people do for like, you know,
counting or
accounts, yeah, that kind of thing. But the fact that it sounded like he still was in possession of it was a red really flag changed. For me. Yeah, absolutely.
So when I first started watching it, when they spoke to Pistol, her son, and then when they spoke to Rob and they weren't in the same room, that was immediately a red flag, because I thought, that's a bit strange. They usually have the family and they're all together and they're talking about how much they loved her and this kind of thing. And I just thought, that's immediately not a good sign. I just can't believe that he wouldn't let him get any of the possessions or anything. It just shows such an utter disregard for her as well, because she loved Pistol. So you would think, you know, if he loved her as much as he said he did, which clearly just wanted to possess her, he would, you know, extend that love to the son, or at least extend some kind of normal decency towards him.
Absolutely.
The same with the remains. That absolutely made me sick. I hated watching him handle them. I hated him kind of dumping it on the table and being like, oh, this 1 pound bag of dust is just, that's her, I've got her, and he'll never get her. And I just thought, that just tells me everything that I need to know about how you felt towards her. Sounds like she was such a happy, loving, friendly, bubbly, just a vibrant person. And then even the way that he said when she cut his hair, he said, she's going to be my wife. There's something about that that just...
It's just all very possessive, isn't it? It's all about control, you know, not even about... And even after the fact, like, it's not enough that he's killed her, because I'm convinced that he did.
Yeah,
It's not enough that he's done that, but he's still controlling after the fact. And it's one of those things, isn't it? I think it's textbook, like, once they can no longer control the person, but then they'll still continue to do things. So him holding on to her ashes, him refusing to allow her son access the house, all this is just an extension of that control of the situation.
It just shows how much of a sociopath he must be to be able to sit on camera. And that must have been such an ego boost for him to be on that documentary, sitting there. They'll be smirking on the inside. Oh, I'll tell my story. Oh, that's weird. We never argued at all. I don't know what all of her family and friends are talking about. Oh, wait, and her son who lived in the same house. No, I don't know what they're talking about at all. We had a perfect relationship. We were so in love. I mean, what planet is this guy on? Who does he think he's kidding? Yeah. Unbelievable. Oh, I could string him up, honestly.
And also, can we just talk about how creepy it was that he had all her bones laid out?
We had to stop and rewind, right? We had to stop and rewind and listen to that part again. I couldn't handle it. Richard looked at me and said, that's not usual practice, is it? I was like, no, that's not usual practice. When you get your dead wife's bones back, you don't get them laid out. And then he said that he kissed them, and then he picked up her skull.
He picked up her skull and walked around the room with it. And then he kissed her. But, and also, yeah, it was the statement he made, like, this is her, or this is all that's left of her, something along those lines, like, or this is her now, something like that.
Strange way of phrasing it, really creepy. Super creepy. Yeah, that guy is, I wouldn't be surprised if there's more bodies in places that we don't know about, because he is one scary, scary man.
I wonder if he had like any previous wives or anything. I wonder if it was like a Carol Baskin type situation.
Yeah,
totally. You know, a previous wife that died or went missing under suspicious circumstances. I would not be surprised.
No.
But do you know what kind of broke my heart a little was the fact that her son was saying that his mum and dad were still such good friends and they spoke every day.
Yeah.
And they still jointly parented him. And it seemed that even like his dad was devastated by the loss of her. And I just thought that is heartbreaking.
Just everyone. You could tell that there was so many people who they probably could have had hundreds of people that they could have spoken to who just would have spoken so highly of her. It just sounded like, you know, everyone that she came into contact with thought she was such a fun person and that she just cheered everyone up. There's some people that just light up a room and you could kind of just tell from the pictures of looking at her and the way that her friends were. And yeah, it's just sadly, people like that often do draw people to them that want to extinguish that light, and it's just sickening, really. But yeah, we highly recommend the series to anyone who's not watched it yet. It's really good. Although I did notice there was a random French episode that popped up. So we didn't have subtitles, though. It didn't come up with subtitles. Did you have to turn them on?
I always have my subtitles on Netflix anyway.
Okay. So ours just came on fully in French. we're just waiting for subtitles to kick in, and we're looking at each other thinking, have we fallen into some kind of French hole somewhere in Netflix?
That was also a really good episode, Emma, so I would watch it.
I think I know the case behind it. Is it the one where the dad vanished and all the rest of the family were found? Yes. So I know of that case already. And there's still like sightings of him around the world and stuff like that. He was really wealthy and they all were murdered. Yeah, I know that case anyway. So I'll be interested to see what they've done with it, because I read up on it a good few years ago anyway. It's exciting.
Yeah, if you get the subtitles, watch it, and then we can discuss it.
Definitely.
We could just do like a weekly unsolved mysteries discussion.
It's like a podcast within a podcast.
I would be very surprised if any of our listeners would not also be very interested in unsolved mysteries.
Yeah, I think they'd love it. Absolutely.
Speaking of which,
what have you got for me today?
So this case, this might be a bit longer than normal because there's actually two murders in this one, but it seemed like a really intriguing case. It's one that I haven't heard of before. I don't know if you have. It's the Templeton Woods murders.
Don't think so.
So it's the murder of Carol Lannan and Elizabeth McCabe.
It rings the vaguest bell. Please enlighten me.
Okay. So this happened in Dundee. For those out with Scotland who are unaware of the geography of this case, Dundee is the fourth largest city in Scotland and is situated on the east coast, approximately 60 miles north of Edinburgh. Carol Lannan was 18 years old, and she was the youngest of five children. She'd been brought up under difficult circumstances, and she appeared to have an unhappy home life. Her father was sent to prison for theft when Carol was a child, and she ended up in care. A classmate described Carol as being an unhappy child who wasn't receptive to attempts to befriend her. The classmate stated that she didn't recall Carol smiling once throughout the time she knew her, and she didn't have any friends. After struggling to fit in, Carol left school at the age of 16, and she had a baby boy in December 1978. In March 1979, Carol Lannan, then 18 years old and a part-time sex worker, was seen getting into a red Ford in what was then Dundee's red light district. Some reports state that the car was a Ford Cortina, but other reports state it was a Ford Escort, and some said it was an estate car, a Ford estate. So basically had a big boot on it anyway, whichever it was. A description of the man seen driving the car and picking up Carol stated that he was around 25 to 30 years old, thin, pale, had short dark brown hair, sideburns and a moustache.
Sounds like every stereotypical 1970s serial killer description.
It does, doesn't it?
Makes me feel really sad hearing that description of her as a little girl.
It's horrible, isn't it? I mean, I was reading it and I was like, this is so sad.
It's heartbreaking.
She was in care. She was miserable all through school from, you know, what I can gather. She left at 16. She's already, you know, she's working as a part-time sex worker at age 18. She's already got a little boy.
Do we know anything about the father of the child?
No, there was no father named on the birth certificate. Don't know who he is. On the 21st of March 1979, so the next day, Carol's body is discovered by rabbit hunters in Templeton Woods in Dundee. She had been strangled and was found bound and naked next to a picnic bench. Her handbag and clothing was not found at the scene. 2 weeks later, her handbag and clothing was found on the banks of the River Don near Kintore in Aberdeen, 85 miles north of where she was found.
Yep, I was just about to say that is really far away.
It is, isn't it? I wondered if it could have, because they're both on the coast, wondered if it'd
be quite hard for it to wash in that far.
Yeah, when you look at where the River Don is in Kintore, it is quite far in.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
It seems more likely that it was dumped.
How did they tie them together, the belongings? How did they know that they were hers?
Her identity was in it.
Oh, I see. Okay. Mm-hmm.
There was a, inside the handbag was a, like a child allowance book.
Okay, yeah.
So,
like
yeah.
Child benefits sort of back then.
I think so, yeah. And her purse and everything with money in it.
How did they identify her body then?
Didn't say.
I'm wondering if they found her belongings and then tied them together. It probably had a picture of her in there.
Yeah, I'm not sure.
Did she have family that we know of? That, or was it just her in care for herself?
I think it was just her in care. To be honest, I didn't see anything confirming otherwise. An eFit was released of the description of the man seen to be picking Carol up in the Red Ford. Despite this, along with the in-depth investigation, the police were no closer to bringing the killer to justice. 11 months later, in February 1980, 20-year-old Elizabeth McCabe, who was a trainee nursery nurse and described as shy, quiet, and from a close-knit family, was found naked, bound, and strangled in Templeton Woods, just 150 yards from where Carol was found. Vaginal swabs found traces of semen, but no accounts confirm whether she had been sexually assaulted. Now, I don't know if that perhaps indicates that she could have engaged in consensual sex before she was found because she was out on a night out. I'm not sure. There was nothing to confirm that she'd been sexually assaulted.
Depends on the injuries as well, doesn't it, as well?
Yeah, literally it just said traces of semen were found, but that was the only context that was given. Elizabeth had been enjoying a night out with a friend in the city centre. She'd left home and went to a few pubs before ending the night at Teaser's Disco. There was mention of a row between Elizabeth and her friend in the bathroom of the nightclub, and Elizabeth left alone at 12:30 a.m. Her body was found 16 days later on the eve of her 21st birthday, on the 26th of February 1980.
Can we just quickly state that never leave a nightclub by yourself, even if you're arguing with your friends, even if you have to call someone to come pick you up. Don't just wander out into the night, please, yeah. For the love of God.
Absolutely. Her handbag and clothes were also missing from the crime scene. So just like Carol's. Elizabeth's handbag was found the following month, miles away in an area called Cobden Street in Dundee. Now, this is a really bizarre detail. Her handbag was found, I believe, with a photograph and some jewellery by a woman that went to a sort of derelict or abandoned area because it was good for finding scrap metal. And that's where the handbag was found. However, in that same area, 2 or 3 weeks later, the same woman found her shoes, but she said that they hadn't been exposed to the elements.
So they weren't there the first time when she found the handbag.
So it doesn't sound like they were there the first time she found the handbag. And then 2 to 3 weeks later, they were then suddenly found as if they'd been dumped in the same area, in a separate.
I mean, we obviously know that the person is likely local anyway, because like where the bodies were found. But yeah, I mean, absolutely. If they're able to frequent that specific part, and you'd need to know that that was a kind of derelict bit. You know, you're not going to dump it somewhere like that unless you knew about it.
Yeah, that was a bizarre detail. Her clothing was found on Cooper Angus Road in mid to late February, not far from where Elizabeth was found. So her clothing was not far from where she was found, but then her shoes and handbag were found in separate instances miles away.
So, and that was city centre, was it? That was part of Dundee, in the city somewhere?
Yeah, I believe so. I'm not sure if it was city centre, but it was in Dundee. Whereas I believe the Templeton Woods are on the north edge of Dundee, apparently. Mm-hmm. So despite the similarities between the two, police have ruled out that the two cases are connected. So even though they were both found naked, bound and strangled, and the handbags and clothes missing, and they were also found 150 yards apart from each other, 11 months apart.
Do they think one was a copycat then? Is that what the...
They haven't said. And it's presumably they're keeping certain things to themselves because it's not been solved, you know, so maybe there will be details that they haven't released to the public.
I would hate to think, you know, any part of it's to do with the fact that one of them was a sex worker and one wasn't.
I don't think it is, because they've been heavily investigated, more than once. So it seems that it doesn't seem like it's for lack of interest. Police actually considered the possibility of the girls being victims of the Yorkshire Ripper, Peter Sutcliffe, following a secret investigation by Yorkshire Police. And for those that don't know, Peter Sutcliffe is a British serial killer convicted of the murder of 13 women and the attempted murder of a further seven between 1975 and 1980. He's currently serving a whole life sentence and he's been in prison since 1981. Now, police also considered the possibility that the girls were victims of Angus Sinclair, who was convicted of the murder of Christine Eady and Helen Scott, both aged 17, from Edinburgh in 1977. The murders were dubbed the World's End murders after the girls were last seen leaving the World's End pub on the Royal Mile in Edinburgh. Now, Angus Sinclair was originally acquitted in 2007, but the police launched Operation Trinity after his acquittal, which was a joint investigation between multiple police forces and investigated seven unsolved murders, including the World's End murders and the Templeton Woods murders. So they were investigated as part of that as well.
Okay.
Angus Sinclair was retried in 2014 after the law was changed in regards to double jeopardy. And he was found guilty of both the murders of Christine Eady and Helen Scott. And he was suspected of killing six others. And he died in prison in 2019. Now, bizarrely, and I know this will interest you because we've talked about Zodiac before. And as you know, I am massively intrigued by the Zodiac Killer and anything to do with him. So there are also articles confirming a dossier was given to police in 2005. Stating that the Zodiac Killer was responsible for the murders. The dossier apparently claimed that the Zodiac Killer left Northern California and came to Scotland, and Carol Lennon and Elizabeth McCabe were his final victims. However, police in California quashed that theory. But it's just a very strange link. I don't know where that's come from.
Yeah, he would have needed to be there for at least a year then.
Yeah.
And no... parts of Dundee and the surrounding area very intimately.
Yeah, and I mean, I don't know what the link was. I don't know who compiled that dossier and what information was used to compile it. It's really bizarre. In 2004, the investigation was ramped up in light of new forensic evidence, and a former taxi driver named Vincent Simpson, who operated a private hire taxi company in Dundee, he was charged. Vincent Simpson was initially interviewed in March 1980 after he completed a questionnaire and returned it to police confirming that he had been in Templeton Woods the night that Elizabeth McCabe was murdered.
I have a question. What was the deal with the questionnaire? Did they distribute it to a bunch of people?
Yeah. Yeah, so they did about 7,000 interviews. And they sent out a bunch of questionnaires, basically to sort of rule people out, I think. And he completed one of the questionnaires and returned it, admitting that he was in Templeton Woods the night that she died. So he was interviewed by police in March 1980. So she was found dead on the 26th of February. He was interviewed, I believe, at the beginning of March 1980. So really soon after,
yeah,
in regards to it. But after the revamp of the investigation in 2004, he was charged.
Okay.
So he was charged in 2005 and tried in 2007.
Okay.
Now, Vincent Simpson, as I say, he was initially interviewed in March 1980. After 7 weeks in court, the jury found him not guilty. And the court heard that there were concerns about forensic contamination for a number of reasons. Now, it's alleged that items were not stored correctly. Correct protocols were not taken by the lab handling and testing the evidence. The police who removed the body at the time did not wear protective clothing. The scene was not protected. And the mortician was not wearing gloves when he removed jewellery from Elizabeth's body. So it's likely that there are current procedures now, but they might not have been in place at the time that her body was found. Maybe some of them were and they weren't followed. Maybe others weren't. But basically, as forensics go, it seems like it was a bit of a shit show.
Yeah, just because if there was concerns even about the lab testing them, I mean, surely that's up to date. So that means they didn't even get it right for the most recent batch.
Yes. So in 2005, presumably, or 2004, when the testing was done, both Vincent Simpson's and Elizabeth McCabe's belongings had been in the same environment.
For goodness sake.
So they couldn't rule out contamination. And the person who worked in the lab actually said they wouldn't be comfortable, you know, testifying that evidence was sound because
that's
of
so frustrating.
Because of the mistakes made. And I think there was also a mistake made in the paperwork as well. So yeah, I mean, as forensics go, sort of from beginning to end, it was a bit of a shit show. They obviously brought a charge anyway. The jury considered what was presented to them, and they decided that he was not guilty.
Okay. And obviously they were still not tying the two murders together. So this was literally just for the one murder. Did they look at him at all for the other murder at all? Did they try and tie him to it or no?
Don't know.
Okay.
This was just for Elizabeth McCabe's murder, so she was the second to be murdered.
I mean, I say it's frustrating, but actually it's also encouraging to know that if you were innocent and, you know, evidence was cross-contaminated, that you wouldn't be found guilty. So I guess for the sake of justice and being in a fair criminal justice system, it's actually a good thing that was the way that it came out.
Yeah, absolutely. And also, you know, thinking from her family's point of view, if the police said to me, hey, your family member's been murdered, we have a bunch of forensic evidence, or, you know, we've done a bunch of forensic testing, but we're not sure if it's reliable, so we're not going to bother trying to bring a charge.
Yeah.
You know, it's up to them to present what they have and for the jury to determine whether that is sufficient, you know, to prove their guilt beyond a reasonable doubt or not.
Absolutely. And I think in those sort of cases where there's multiple errors made, I think that just muddies the water so much that could you as a juror live with yourself and putting someone away? You know, are you absolutely sure? I don't think I could be in those sort of instances, especially if the lab technicians and the people dealing with the evidence themselves are saying, I can't testify to the, you know, the correctness.
Integrity.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. That is really, really hard, though, because what if he did do it?
Absolutely. So Scotland is the only country in the UK which does not have the similar fact evidence law, which means that under Scots law, a jury cannot hear about an accused's previous convictions, which we've spoke about on previous episode, even where the other crimes are very similar in circumstances, except in exceptional circumstances, which leads me to the exceptional circumstances rule, which is the Murov doctrine. Okay. Have you heard of this?
I don't think so, no.
Okay. So the Murov doctrine, so this is the definition of the Murov doctrine. The Murov doctrine is a rule that holds that the evidence of one witness can corroborate the evidence of another in certain situations if the Crown can prove that the accused's offending was part of a course of conduct systematically pursued. And the description of it seems to indicate that they have to be closely related in time.
Okay.
But it doesn't, it's very open to interpretation.
Yeah, that is quite vague.
Yeah, it is. So it seems that if you can apply the Murov doctrine, then
you can introduce a prior conviction.
Yes.
If they're close enough.
Yes.
In time. Right, okay.
Yeah. But if you can't, then it's the usual rule of thumb. You cannot tell the jury about an accused's previous convictions. And this argument came up because the serial killer Peter Tobin, so he lived in Scotland and England. Mm-hmm. And when he was in Scotland, he murdered Vicky Hamilton. He murdered Vicky Hamilton in Bathgate in Scotland, and he murdered Dinah McNichol in England.
Yeah.
Now, although he was tried for both of those crimes, in England, the case of Dinah McNichol, they were able to hear about his previous convictions. But for Vicky Hamilton's court case, the jury weren't allowed to hear about his previous convictions. So although it was the same defendant, the cases were
treated differently.
So this argument came up. Now, one guy who is apparently a previous police officer, I think he's been involved. He's still involved in cold cases. He's reviewed a bunch of stuff. He's had involvement in it. He believes that if the Scots law is reviewed or the Murov doctrine can be applied, they can consider, or they could have considered, Angus Sinclair for these crimes, because okay. he was convinced that Angus Sinclair was guilty of these crimes due to the similarities in the nature of them. But Angus Sinclair died in 2019. So, and I assume that he didn't confess to these murders. But basically, he's made an argument to say the law, the similar fact evidence law, is a really useful law to have. And it's a hindrance. It's sort of, he didn't say it's a hindrance, but it sounded like he was saying it's to the detriment of Scotland that we don't have it because it's valuable. And I know we've spoke about the same before as well, that it is valuable to know.
Yeah, I think if I was a juror, I would be supremely frustrated to say, do you know what, there's just not enough evidence. There's differing evidence as to his character. In my mind, you know, his mum saying he would never do anything like that. You know, you've got all that kind of stuff that comes in. And then you find out he's done the exact same thing to somebody else before. And that is evidence in my mind. That is evidence. It's just as important as whether the hair on the jumper matched or whatever to me, knowing about that person's background and crimes that they've committed previously, especially if they're similar.
For sure. Yeah, for sure.
Really difficult.
So no one else has been charged with Elizabeth McCabe's murder, despite an extensive investigation into the murders of both girls, which has included 7,000 interviews, all hotels, boarding houses and B&Bs in the cities being visited, and all taxi firms questioned. Despite the police debunking the theories that the murders are linked due to details they presumably haven't released to the public, the murders remain known as the Templeton Woods murders, and nobody has ever been charged with the murder of Carol Lennon.
That is so sad.
So that is the case of the Templeton Woods murders. Horrible, isn't it? And you know, again, I haven't heard of this case.
The one I'm thinking of is actually one that I was thinking about covering anyway, if you weren't going to at some point, and it was the murder of a couple of sex workers outside Glasgow who were dumped in woods out there. Can't remember their names off the top of my head.
They might be the victims that Angus Sinclair suspected of killing.
I believe that might be the ones. I watched a documentary on them a while ago.
It was quite a long one this week, two cases, but important. And obviously, the usual applies. If anybody has any information that can assist police, they can contact Crime Stoppers on 0800 555 111, or they can contact Police Scotland on 101. And I expect that their families are still very much awaiting justice for the murders, and any information that anyone can give to help would be fantastic. What we'll do is, on the Instagram post, I will also put a picture of the EFIT of the man who was seen picking up Carol Lennon in the red Ford on the night that she went missing. I'll add that to the Instagram post so people can have a look at it, and hopefully it might trigger someone's memory. Who knows?
I always think with these ones, because it's been so long, if someone was protecting someone, hopefully any allegiances might have lapsed by that point. I could be totally wrong, but you never know. There could be someone who said, yeah, my husband came back on both those nights and was shaken, and we had a red Ford, and I saw the belongings in the boot of his car. I mean, I'm completely wishing on a star here, but, you know, you never know, something like that could happen. So fingers crossed something comes of it.
Definitely. So do you have a crew crime? I'm not even finished my first gin yet. Do you have a true crime fact for us?
I actually kind of copied you slightly in that you had one about laws last week.
Right, okay.
So I've gone for another one, but just because I really enjoyed the title. So this is funny laws in the UK. Did you know it's illegal to handle salmon in suspicious circumstances?
What?
This is a recent law, which makes it even more absurd. It's from 1986.
Are you kidding me?
No, it's under the Salmon Act of 1986.
Oh, I was going to say, is this something to do with the, like, the fishing?
It's to do with illegal fishing.
Illegal fishing, yeah.
So the way that it's worded is, it is an offence to receive or dispose of salmon under suspicious circumstances. So I've just got images of, like, secret handovers in parks, like spies, yeah, and things like that. But it's not a briefcase, it's a salmon. And yeah, they're just trying to be super sly about it. And people are like, hang on, that looks a bit suspicious.
Yeah, like a guy seen running away with a brown paper bag that's like flapping wildly.
Yeah. Just the eyes poking through the little holes. I love that. It's so ridiculous.
I love how it's so vaguely worded.
I really enjoy the fact that someone somewhere was paid good money to write that act. Oh, mm-hmm. So you're a lawyer. Oh, what do you do? Oh, actually, I help write laws that get passed in Parliament. And it's like, oh my gosh, that's amazing. You must make such a difference to the world. Yeah, I do, actually. I'm really proud of myself. What are you working on at the minute? Maybe you want to hear about one of my older laws, Steve. You'll have heard of this other one first. It's just
like... What is the law? You acted suspiciously with a salmon. What is it actually called?
I think that's something else.
Right.
It's an offence to receive or dispose of salmon under suspicious circumstances.
Oh, okay, so if you see something fishy, then you should call the police.
Oh, no. But what if they think it's just a red herring? Thank you for listening. If you have a case that you'd like us to consider covering, you can get in contact with us. Our email address is info@murdershespoke.net. You can also find us on Facebook, on Instagram, and on Twitter @MurderSheSpokePodcast. If you would like to, you can leave us a rating and a 5-star review on your favourite podcast platform. Thank you so much. We'll see you in a week.